following program is intended for mature audiences.
Get off the babysitter. Put on your pants. Come out with your hands up.
They used to bounce messages across the earth. Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show. Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows? Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
Truth, the half-truth, and nothing of the truth. Veritas News, now with Sal Manella.
Good evening, this is Sal Manella with the Veritas News. President derelict Trump's new Mueller investigation, defense lawyer Joe DiGenova, claims that former FBI head James Comey and former FBI deputy Andrew McCabe have framed the president. DiGenova once defended the now convicted members of New York's Covfefe crime family. While some see DiGenova's defense of someone of high stature like the President of the United States as above his expertise, he sees it simply as a transformation from defending people accused of literally giving victims the axe to Trump's figuratively axing of people in the form of firings. In a poll conducted by Pew Research, most Americans don't care if Trump's being framed, but the overwhelming majority agree they'd like to see Trump's head stuffed and mounted on the border wall separating Mexico from the United States. Mexicans, while sympathetic to the majority of Americans wanting Trump's head possibly framed, but definitely mounted on the border wall, suggest the president's cabeza be positioned on the U.S. side. They assure the world that if the president's severed head were mounted on the Mexican side of the wall, it would be destroyed by El Presidente Vicente Fox, who'd most assuredly use it as a piñata. This has been Sal Manila with the Veritas News. Now here's Tom Savino with Savino Veritas.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tom Savino here, live from Burbank, California, with another Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, the fine wine of select gripes. Tonight's episode, Thorough Thrashing Walden. Will we be able to transcend the confinement of fascist walls? What does Thoreau say? Can you regain your sanity with a blockade of all media from yourself? Hear that and more tonight on Savino Veritas. Join us now. The transcendentalists are my heroes, while I appreciate all of them. Walt Whitman, my fellow Brooklynite. Emily Dickinson, representing the superior sex. My favorites were Emerson and Thoreau. Of the two, Thoreau gets my top honors. For periods of my life, his On Walden Pond was my Bible. And that's gospel. Henry would be overjoyed to know I'd give Walden 4.5 stars out of 5 today on Yelp. The only fault I find in it is one aphorism. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I still think, even then, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, or devolution as I call it, it was a no-brainer to simply write simplicity just once. 3 simplicities is contradictory and antithetical to simplicity itself. Today we can learn much from Henry David Thoreau. Read On Walden Pond, and you'll find yourself looking at the screen of a cell phone or an iPad a lot less. Consider reading on Walden Pond on a screen or a cell phone or an iPad, and you'll find yourself dead, shot in the head between your eyes by me personally or some other fellow surviving transcendentalist who will definitely find such an anti-transcendental act as reading the transcendentalist on an electronic device unacceptable, sacrilegious. While there's much to learn from Thoreau, let me teach you a little bit about Thoreau. It is a common error to think he said, quote, "That government that governs least governs best." You can find those words written in his famous essay on civil disobedience. But he was quoting our third president, Thomas Jefferson. In using that quotation without attributing the source, antiquity has erroneously given him credit for the phrase. On that note, therefore, let me take this opportunity now to say, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Well, I want to know about this.
What, too soon? What Thoreau wrote in Civil Disobedience was this, quote, "I heartily accept the motto that government is best which governs least," end quote. Now you might be thinking, what? Thomas Savino agrees with that? That's so Republican.
What? Oh my.
Whoa, what?
Well, not so fast, amigo. And I can call you amigo when talking about Thoreau because he wrote Civil Disobedience while in jail for refusing to pay a tax because he knew those tax dollars collected at the time were used to fund the bogus war against Mexico. The war we used to rationalize stealing much of Mexico's land. As I speak these words now in Southern California, I am reminded that I am broadcasting from what was once Mexico. Thoreau knew that war was fabricated solely for the purpose of taking Mexico's land without the express consent of Major League Baseball, should have been strictly prohibited. What Thoreau did write was this, quote, "I heartily accept the motto, that government is best which governs least, and I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically carried out. It finally amounts to this, which also I believe, that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have. Government is at best but an expedient. But most governments are usually, and all governments are sometimes, inexpedient." Is Thoreau prophetic? Today, the United States of America is hobbled by the most inexpedient government we've ever had, at least in my lifetime. Certainly Trump and his kleptocrats,
be careful, son, I can sue you,
are bent on achieving not just government that governs least, but one that governs not at all. While libertarians and the brain dead think that's a great idea, we here in 2018 are clearly not prepared to enjoy government that governs not at all. We can't survive either, at least not yet, in our social development, a government that governs least. The phrase bent on achieving certainly reminds me they are indeed crooked. What with the cabinet secretary Zinke spending over $100,000, $100,000 of our tax dollars just on office doors, and that's just the interior. Well, friends, Henry David Thoreau went to Walden Pond to live deliberately. He isolated himself purposely from the people in Concord, Massachusetts, to live with nature and to really explore what life is all about. He isolated himself from people for 2 years in writing Walden. I totally recommend communing with nature meditating, whether you can do it in nature or in your room or in your car, going within, I definitely recommend that. But unlike a man who we're going to learn about now from the New York Times piece, I don't think we should isolate ourselves totally, because we need to communicate with each other on how we are going to beat the rap, so to speak, and beat this corrupt administration that is killing the republic with the help of Vladimir Putin and Russians and oligarchs. We do need to join together and stand up to this fascist regime. We need to do it together. It is an irony that we can't depend on the protections of government anymore, that we need to rescue the government, and that we have so often expected the government to rescue us. But we are the government. That's the point. We, the people, are the government. And we can no longer wait for the government that governs least to rescue us, or the government that governs not at all to rescue us. We need to rescue it, because we are rescuing ourselves. Now here's the man who knew too little from the New York Times.
Do you hear about Trump?
Be careful, son, I can sue you.
This is from Athens, Ohio. Damon Winter of the New York Times wrote this, and he wrote it about Eric Hagerman, who lives in Athens, Ohio. And the name of this piece is The Man Who Knew Too Little. The most ignorant man in America knows that Donald Trump is president, but that's about it. Living a liberal fantasy is complicated. I need to remind everyone that this is Tom Savino coming to you live from in Burbank, California, where it is raining, believe it or not. And reminding you that Lion's Den Studios, as well equipped as it is with audio equipment, it is not soundproof, nor is it foolproof, as regular listeners will attest. So you may hear rain, pitter-patter of raindrops, pitter-patter of little feet, maybe the pitter-patter of little tweets, and whatever. You may hear all that here on Savino Veritas tonight, live from Burbank, California, on a very rainy night. The East Coast is pounded once again, fourth time, with a nor'easter. I don't know what happened to the TH in that. It used to be Northeaster, but now it's Nor'easter. And here it is raining and a downpour. We really need the rain. Unfortunately, we've also had some major fires not too long ago that destroyed the foliage that used to soak in the water, and now there's nothing to soak in the water, and the water just rolls down a hill with mud, and we do have flash flood warnings, and also the flight path of Burbank Airport changes on rainy nights, so you might hear more of that. Remember, we are not foolproof, we're not soundproof. We are 80-proof, though. Anyway, so here it is, the man who knew too little, Gloucester, Ohio. At first, the experiment didn't have a name. Right after the election, Eric Hager decided he'd take a break from reading about the hoopla of politics. Donald Trump's victory shook him.
You're not alone.
Badly. And so Mr. Hagerman developed his own eccentric experiment. One that was part silent protest, part coping mechanism, part extreme self-care plan. He swore that he would avoid learning about anything that happened to America after November the 8th, 2016. Quote, it was draconian and complete, end quote, he said. Quote, it's not like I wanted to just steer away from Trump or shift the conversation. It was like I was a vampire and any photon of Trump would turn me to dust, end quote. It was just going to be for a few days, but he is now more than a year into knowing almost nothing about American politics.
His not wanting to know would indicate that he's not a Trump supporter. But now that he knows almost nothing about politics, he has put himself in the exact category of Trump supporters. I know nothing. That's what they want to know. Back to the article.
He's managed to become shockingly uninformed during one of the most eventful chapters in modern American history. He is as ignorant as a contemporary citizen could ever hope to be. James Comey, Russia, Robert Mueller, Las Vegas, the travel ban, alternative facts, pussy hats, Scaramucci, Parkland, big nuclear buttons, Roy Moore. To Mr. Hagerman, life is a spoiler. I just look at the weather, said Mr. Hagerman, 53, who lives alone on a big farm in southeastern Ohio. But it's only so diverting. He says he has gotten used to a feeling that he hasn't experienced in a long time. I'm bored, he said, but it's not bugging me. It takes meticulous planning to find boredom. Mr. Hagerman commits as hard as a method actor and his self-imposed regimen. White noise tapes at the coffee shop, awkward scolding of friends, a ban on social media, has reshaped much of his life. Extreme as it is, it's a path that likely holds some appeal for liberals these days. A DIY version.
Do it yourself, I guess.
Of moving to Canada. Democrats, liberals, and leftists have coped with the first year of the Trump presidency in lots of ways. Some subsist on the thin gruel of political cartoon shows and online impeachment petitions. Others dwell online in the thrilling place where conspiracy is indistinguishable from truth. Others have been inspired to action, making their first run for public office, taking local action, or marching in their first protest rally. Mr. Hagerman has done the opposite of all of them. It's working for him. I'm emotionally healthier than I've ever felt, he said. Has made him question the very value of being fed each day by the media. Why do we bother tracking faraway political developments and distant campaign speeches? What good comes of it? Why do we read all these tweets anyway? I had been paying attention to the news for decades, Mr. Hagerman said, and I never did anything with it. At some point last year, he decided his experiment needed a name. He considered the embargo, but it sounded too temporary. The boycott? It came off a little whiny. Mr. Hagerman has created a fortress around himself. Tiny little boats of information can be dangerous, he said. He decided that it would be called the blockade. Behind the blockade for a guy who has gone to great lengths to essentially plug his ears. Mr. Hagerman sure does talk a lot.
How can you sit here and talk and talk and talk like this?
I'm getting tired of that kind of talk.
He is witty and discursive, punctuating his stories with wide-eyed grins, exaggerated grimaces, and more than occasional lost thread. I recently spent 2 days visiting his farm on the condition that I not bring news from the outside world. As the sun set over his porch, turning the rolling hills pink, then purple, then blue, he held forth, jumping from English architecture to the local pig's eating habits, to his mother's favorite basketball team, to the philosophy of Kant. Kant.
Kant. Kant.
Immanuel Kant.
Pussy.
Immanuel Kant.
Pussy.
Immanuel Kant.
Pussy.
He can go days without seeing another soul. His life is still fairly new. Just a few years ago, he was a corporate executive at Nike, senior director of global digital commerce, was his official unwieldy title.
Now let me see, what is it you call your job? Oh, yes, public relations. Sounds like something pretty dirty to me.
It's never ending, your bullshit.
working with teams of engineers to streamline the online shopping experience. Before that, he had worked digital jobs at Walmart and Disney. I work 12, 14 hours a day, he said, the calendar completely booked. But 3 years ago, he decided he had saved enough money to move to a farm.
If I may be so blunt, who gives a shit?
Make elliptical sculptures.
Whoa, what?
And eventually opt out of the national conversation entirely. He lives alone and has never been married. As for money, a financial advisor in San Francisco manages his investments. Mr. Hagerman says he throws away the quarterly updates without reviewing them. Mr. Hagerman grew up in southeastern Ohio, and after years spent in Brooklyn warehouses, San Francisco tech bubbles, and Nike land in Portland, Oregon, the idea of a quiet life became more and more appealing. His mother lives nearby. He sees her a lot since he moved back in 2015. She reluctantly adheres to the blockade, although they do discuss the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Mr. Hagerman begins every day with a 30-minute drive to Athens.
Greece is pretty... I didn't know you could drive from Ohio to Greece. Oh, Athens, Ohio.
I don't think that's funny.
You imbecile! You bloated idiot!
Mr. Hagerman begins every day with a 30-minute drive to Athens, the closest city of note, to get a cup of coffee, a triple-shot latte with whole milk. He goes early, before most customers have settled into their oversized chairs, to scroll through their phones. To make sure he doesn't overhear idle chatter, he often listens to white noise through the headphones. He used to listen to music, but stray conversation can creep in between songs. At Donkey Coffee.
Make an ass out of yourself at Donkey Coffee.
Everyone knows his order, and they know about the blockade. Our baristas know where he's at, so they don't engage him on topics that would make him uncomfortable.
Do me a fucking favor. Shut up, listen, and learn.
Said Angie Pyle, the coffee shop's co-owner. Mr. Hagerman has also trained his friends, a close friend from his Nike days, Parinaz Vahabzadeh.
You don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
Didn't think he was quite serious at first, and in the early days of the blockade kept dropping little hints about politics. The new administration compelled her to engage more deeply in politics, not less. She had only recently become a United States citizen, and she was passionate about the immigration debate. She did not let Mr. Hagerman opt out easily. I was needling him, she said.
Trying to sow discontent, I guess.
And in response, she received for the first time a stern text message.
I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing.
I am now officially cross with you, he wrote. As you know very well, I don't wish to hear about current events.
Oh, that's a shame.
I know you don't agree with my wishes, but I do expect you to respect them. They now speak on the phone several times a week, but never about the news. I've gotten used to it, she said. It's actually nice to not talk about politics. Conversations with Mr. Hagerman can have a Rip Van Winkle quality. He spoke several times about his sister, Bonnie, an assistant professor who lives in, of all places, Charlottesville, Virginia. While he and I were talking, I looked over at him at every mention of Charlottesville to see if the name of the city, home to perhaps the ugliest weekend of the Trump era to date, made him flinch. So do you associate Charlottesville, I would say the name deliberately and with emphasis, with anything beside your sister? He didn't bite. I think he really didn't know about the Nazis.
I know nothing, nothing.
Later, he pointed to a house on a hill and said that before the election, the neighbor had decorated his lawn with an effigy of Hillary Clinton behind bars. I wanted to point out that the recently unveiled Mueller indictment found that a Russian troll had paid for a Hillary impersonator at a Florida rally, but I bit my tongue. Mr. Hagerman didn't know about Mueller or Russia or trolls. Last winter, Mr. Hagerman spent several weeks visiting his twin brother, a tech CEO in San Francisco. Strict arrangements had to be made. The Sunday newspaper kept out of sight. The TV switched off. His teenage niece and nephew under special instructions. The bigger challenge was when we have friends come over and visit, said his brother Chris. We had to have Eric not be there, or we would give them a heads up that Eric has this news blockade going, and we gave them the guidelines. They're always a little bemused by it, and to some extent, a little envious, he said. The prospect of just chucking all that for a period of time felt somewhat appealing. To be fair, Mr. Hagerman has made a few concessions. He reads the New York's art reviews, but is careful to flip past the illustrated covers, which often double as political commentary. He watches every Cavaliers game,
old habits die hard,
but only on mute. He counts a few boats that have sailed past the blockade. He saw a picture of Kim Jong-un on a newspaper at the coffee shop, signaling that something was up with North Korea. And he overheard someone saying something about Obamacare, which meant healthcare was back in the news. His brother alerted him to the Equifax breach for his own protection. He said that with some pride.
Wow, look at you. Have you been working out?
But he has the misgivings about disengaging from political life that you have by now surely been shouting at him as you read. The first several months of this thing, I didn't feel all that great about it, he said.
My feelings exactly.
It makes me a crappy citizen. It's the ostrich head in the sand approach to political outcomes you disagree with. Seems obvious to say, but to avoid current affairs is in some ways a luxury that many people, like for example immigrants worried about deportation, cannot afford. He has the privilege of constructing a world in which very little of what he doesn't have to deal with gets through, said his sister Bonnie Hagerman. That's a privilege. We all would like to construct our dream worlds.
Welcome, Fantasy Island.
What if, he began to think, he could address his privilege and the idea of broader good near to home? He has a master project, one that he thinks about obsessively, that he believes can serve as his contribution to American society. He calls it the lake. At the lake. On a recent spookily warm day, Mr. Hagerman clambered up a steep bank of woods, pushing past vines and stepping past fallen logs. Wide-eyed, giddy with excitement, he led the way to a flat stretch of brush where he spread his arms and began talking even faster than usual. This is where we'll build a giant barn. It will feel like a cathedral. The cloister will be here, he said, making reference to Chartres and Oxford and the grandeur of medieval cathedrals. About 9 months ago, he bought some 45 acres of land on the site of a former strip mine.
Take it all. Take it all off.
The property, untouched for decades, has been reclaimed by nature. Deer, beavers.
Nice beaver.
Oh, you are the sly one.
Salamanders and canopies of majestic trees are thriving. He walked further to the edge of the steep drop-off. Below, a bright blue lake shimmered in the February heat like a secret. He'll debate as long as you want whether the body of water counts as a lake or a pond. It's easier if you just agree it's a lake.
So tell me you love me. Please, tell me.
Now, you wouldn't believe how great it feels to go swimming there, he said. He added with almost rapturous glee that the lake sits in the spot where the mining company dug deepest. Mr. Hagerman sees this land as his life's work. He plans to restore it, protect it, live on it, and then preserve it for the public. I will never sell this land, he said.
Is this your final answer?
He wouldn't put it exactly this way, but he talks about the land in part as penances for the moral cost of his blockade. He has come to believe that being a news consumer doesn't enhance society. He also believes that restoring a former coal mine and giving it to the future does. I see it as a contribution that has civic relevance, that aligns with my passions and what I do well, Mr. Hageman said. I'm going to donate it. It's going to take most of my net worth. That's what I'm going to spend the rest of my life on. He has filled an entire room of his house with a 3D rendering of the property to better envision his plans. He has hired Gary Conley, a local landscape ecologist, to advise on the project. Mr. Conley, a gentle bearded outdoorsman who can speak at length about the preferences of local amphibians, believes that the land could become something special. Mr. Conley indulges Mr. Hageman's fantasies for the land, a walkway modeled on an ancient Mayan ball game.
There's no crying in baseball!
Land art inspired by spiral jetty, windows and concrete blocks. So many blocks. But Mr. Conley mainly serves as the straight man to inject ecological reality into the plan. Mr. Conley respects the blockade. After all, the project of the lake might not exist without it. In those carefree pre-Trump days, Mr. Hageman would settle into the coffee shop with his newspaper and dig in. But after the blockade, he could only read the weather.
But as it turns out, only three of the ferrets were related. Well, with Donald Trump about to be sworn in as president, the weather has been pretty blustery. What can we expect, Frank?
Well, Jim, we are seeing a heavy wave of denial coming in from both coasts, trapping a high blood pressure front right in the heart of the country. Now, down south, that's going to push civil unrest back to the mid to early 60s. Now, along the bottom of the coast of California, all the way to the middle of Texas, we're going to be experiencing massive construction fronts, okay? It'll build up slightly, but then fall apart long before it finishes. So, look for scattered bankruptcies there and a much heavier shortfall moving from D.C. up to Wall Street. Now, coming down from the northern border, we can expect giggling and smug looks, followed, of course, by apologies when the Wall Street suckhole just pulls the ground out from under all 50 states.
Heavy stuff, Frank. I guess these days climate change isn't a hoax.
Only morons think that, Jim. But you know what? It's not all bad news. The rise in both temperature and existential misery will be cooled by the nuclear winter coming in from the southeast. Now, that should take out all sentient life on the continent, and we can look for that within the first 100 days. Tammy, you voted for Jill Stein, you thoughtless ass. Now suck it up like the rest of us. Back to you, Jim.
For elderly men, it's endlessly interesting. And the real estate listings. It was during one of those long, boring mornings with no news to read that he found the listing for the lake. The first time I saw it, I said, "This is it," he said.
This is just a nightmare. Soon I'm gonna wake up. Someone's gonna bring me round. Says I want it for a minute. Warning.
Humorist, writer, raconteur, mystic, and parallel parking expert. Thomas Savino.
Through sex, secrets, and spies.
I know people who used to work for MI5.
In the battle for power, democracy has a new front line. Elections around the world are being fought less and less on doorsteps and hustings.
Never shall we lose our faith and courage, and never shall we fail in exertion and resolve.
And more on screens and social media. It's an online information war where often unseen hands harvest your personal data, tapping into your hopes and fears for the greatest political yield. and one British company is at the very heart of it. They've worked under the radar in elections in Nigeria, Kenya, the Czech Republic, India, and Argentina. But they are best known for their work in America.
There can be no prosperity without law and order.
That company is Cambridge Analytica.
Is that immediately recording?
Yeah.
After a four-month undercover investigation, tonight a glimpse into how they really operate. Prepared, it seems, to ruin their clients' opponents through handouts and honey traps.
Send some girls around to Kenny's house.
Through sex, secrets, and spies.
I know people who used to work for MI5, MI6.
Old-style tactics wedded to the new.
We just put information into the bloodstream from the internet and then watch it grow.
Whether the true backdrop or just bravado,
you take care, my friend.
Yes,
this is Cambridge Analytica Uncovered.
Great pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Until next time.
Goodbye, gentlemen. Goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to speak to you about the evolution taking place in marketing and communications.
This is Cambridge Analytica's boss, Alexander Nix. He's become a digital celebrity, headlining last year's Online Marketing Rockstars Festival. Fame followed after being hired by the Trump campaign. Steve Bannon, then a key Trump advisor, had been a vice president of Cambridge Analytica, a de facto founding father. And the company would soon be feted in some quarters as the digital gurus behind that shock victory.
But we were able to use data to identify that there was very large quantities of persuadable voters there that could be influenced to vote for the Trump campaign.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Political campaigns have changed, and elections are won by small but crucial numbers of votes. Putting the right message in front of the right person at the right moment is more important than ever.
Cambridge Analytica acquires and analyzes vast amounts of personal data to identify swing voters, to work out what they care about.
So you know exactly who to target with exactly what type of message.
And then influence them through bespoke adverts on social media.
Hillary Clinton, a danger to national security.
These micro-targeting methods, the company boasts privately, were integral to Trump's victory.
Thank you.
But with success has come notoriety. Trump's opponents have demanded the company's tactics be investigated. Others allege they had a hand in the Brexit campaign. From the shadows, hijacking democracy is the accusation. Cambridge Analytica has always ridiculed these claims, fueled, they say, by the bitter grievances of rivals, beaten opponents, and liberal media. Hoping to get an inside track on Cambridge Analytica, we posed as a potential client of theirs. As an agent from Sri Lanka, together with his assistant, interested in hiring Cambridge Analytica to achieve electoral success in Sri Lanka. The company agrees to meet, the setting a hotel in London's Belgravia. Up first, Alex Taylor, their chief data officer, and managing director Mark Turnbull, two of the most senior figures in Cambridge Analytica.
Good afternoon.
No, hello.
Mark Turnbull.
Mark Turnbull.
Very pleased
Alex
to meet
Taylor.
You.
How do you do?
Ranjan.
Our fixer says he's working for a wealthy Sri Lankan family, wondering how Cambridge Analytica might help them get future candidates elected. The two businessmen in turn pitch their highly acclaimed data analysis work and their global reach.
If you're collecting data on people and you're profiling them, that gives you more insight that you can use to know how to segment the population, to give them messaging about issues that they care about, and language and imagery that they're likely to engage with. Mm. And we use that in America, and we use that in Africa. That's right. What we do as a company.
Yeah. We've done it in Mexico, we've done it in Malaysia, and now we're moving into Brazil.
China. Brazil is big.
Australia, China.
But China also.
Just starting in China, not in politics.
But when we raise the issue of gleaning intelligence on opponents, suddenly a door opens onto an altogether different form of data gathering.
You mentioned intelligence gathering as well as part of the mix, didn't you?
Yeah, corporate, yes.
We have relationships and partnerships with specialist organizations that do that kind of work. You know who the opposition is, you know their secrets, you know their tactics.
Thank you, Ranjit.
Okay.
Till next time.
Yes.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Such an approach, they've since told us, is not unusual in political campaigns. We'll hear more on that later. Another meeting was arranged, and this time, a fortnight later at a different London hotel, we get from Cambridge Analytica a memorable lesson in modern electoral tactics.
The two fundamental human drivers when it comes to taking information on board, effectively, are hopes and fears, and many of those are unspoken and even unconscious. You didn't know that was a fear until you saw something that just evoked that reaction from you.
Right.
And our job is to drop the bucket further down the well than anybody else, to understand what are those really deep-seated underlying fears, concerns. There's no good fighting an election campaign on the facts, because actually it's all about emotion.
And in one of their recent overseas campaigns, there was no shortage of emotion. In last year's chaotic and at times violent Kenyan elections, the company worked secretly for the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta. The campaign was marked by misinformation. Fake news spread through the internet and smartphones. In one survey, 90% of Kenyans said they'd heard or seen false stories about the election. Apocalyptic videos like this, smearing Kenyatta's opponent, Raila Odinga, went viral in the toxic political atmosphere. This one appears to target specific fears: health, infrastructure, the terror threat, and was heavily promoted on social media and Google. But no one in Kenya seemingly knew who was behind it. Cambridge Analytica strenuously deny any involvement with these videos or any role in negative political campaigning there. In public, they've said little about their recent involvement in Kenya, but in private, it's a source of evident pride.
The Kenyatta campaign, which we ran in 2013 and 2017 for Kenyatta. Mm.
And so what you have done in the Kenya?
We have rebranded the entire party twice, written their manifesto, done two rounds of 50,000 surveys.
Huge amounts of research, analysis, messaging.
Then we'd write all the speeches and we'd stage the whole thing. So just about every element of his campaign. Okay.
Plenty of political parties, of course, hire in consultants to help them win elections, but being able to scrutinise what they do and what tactics they deploy matters. In our next meeting with Mark Turnbull at this Knightsbridge Hotel, we get a startling account of a company prepared to wade into a foreign election and then disappear without a trace. Our fixer is about to bring up the subject of digging dirt on political opponents. And Mark Turnbull says he knows ex-spies in other companies who could help.
There are various intelligence gathering organisations that operate very discreetly to find information like that. I know people who used to work for MI5, MI6. They now work for these
private organisations.
They will find all the skeletons in his closet, quietly, discreetly, give you a report.
And then once the dirt has been dug, outed, discreetly, he goes on to say, at the right moment. Whatever the political message, subtlety is key.
It has to happen without anyone thinking that's propaganda. Because the moment you think that's propaganda, the next question is, who's put that out?
Yes.
So we have to be very subtle.
And for a client worried about anyone discovering Cambridge Analytica's involvement, they've an answer for that too.
It may be that we have to contract under a different name.
For Cambridge Analytica.
A different entity with a different name, so that no record exists with our name attached to this at all.
The invisible power brokers of modern politics. But in their craft, they insist, lies a code of conduct.
So we're not in the business of fake news. We're not in the business of lying, no. Making stuff up. And we're not in the business of entrapment. So we wouldn't send a pretty girl out to seduce a politician and then film them in their bedroom. Right. And then release the film. There are companies that do this. But to me, that crosses a line.
This was a battle cry for electoral ethics, but how hollow it would soon sound.
Hello?
Finally, the man at the helm of Cambridge Analytica, CEO Alexander Nix, has agreed to meet. In a phone call first to our fixer, the final sales pitch begins.
We are not only the largest and most significant political consultancy in the world, but we have the most established track record. We're used to operating through different vehicles in the shadows, and I look forward to building a very long-term and secretive relationship with you.
It would be our final meeting with Cambridge Analytica. Mark Turnbull now joined by his boss, Old Etonian Alexander Nix. This the man who in public eulogises free and fair elections, but who in private, we're about to discover, appears to play dirty. For a company claiming not to be in the business of entrapment, listen now to Alexander Nix when our fixer raises again the topic of digging up damaging material on political opponents.
And what we want to know is, what is the expertise of the deep digging that you can do to make sure that the people know the true identity and secrets of these people?
We do a lot more than that. Deep digging is interesting, but equally effective can be just to go and speak to the incumbents and to offer them a deal that's too good to be true and make sure that that's video recorded. These sorts of tactics are very effective. Instantly having video evidence of corruption,
right,
putting it on the internet, these sorts of things.
And the operative you will use for this is who?
Well, someone known to us.
Okay, so it is somebody. You won't use a Sri Lankan person, no? Because then there's issue.
No, we'll have a wealthy developer come in. Somebody posing as a wealthy developer.
I'm a master of disguise.
Yes. They will offer a large amount of money to the candidate to finance his campaign in exchange for land, for instance. We'll have the whole thing recorded on cameras. Land count face of our guy, and we have posted on the internet.
So it'll on the Facebook or YouTube or something like this. It can be done.
Send some girls around to the candidate's house. We have lots of history of things.
For example, you're saying when you're using the girls to introduce to the local fellow, and you're using the girls for this, like the seduction. They're not local girls, not Sri Lankan girls.
I wouldn't have thought so. They could bring some. That was just an idea.
Yes.
Bring some Ukrainians in on holiday with us.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. They are very beautiful Ukrainian girls.
They are very beautiful.
Yes.
I find that works very well. Please don't pay too much attention to what I'm saying, because I'm just giving you examples of
what can happen,
what can be done, and what has been done.
Yes.
It sounds like electoral power by expose, The poster boy of predictive analytics touting a sideline, you might think, in sex workers and stings. Ethics perhaps somewhat expendable, like the truth.
I mean, it sounds a dreadful thing to say, but these are things that don't necessarily need to be true, as long as they're believed.
Next comes the most illuminating account yet of potential subterfuge. To hide their role from prying eyes, Nick says they can operate in elections under a variety of guises.
So often we set up a... If we are working, then we can set up a... fake IDs and websites. We can go in as students doing research projects attached to the university. We can be tourists.
Right. Well,
there's so many options.
Okay.
We can look at. We have lots of experience.
And for added secrecy, there's always the option of subcontracting into the world of ex-spies.
We've just used a different organisation to run a very, very successful project in an Eastern European country where they did a really... No one even knew they were there. They just ghosted in, did the work, ghosted out and produced really, really good material. So we have experience in doing this.
How is it done with the payment for these organizations where you're using another organization?
So we take care of that. We subcontract to them.
So we pay you and then you will...
We use some British companies. We use some Israeli companies.
Israeli? Which one? Israeli? From Israel?
From Israel.
Right.
Very effective in intelligence gathering.
So there you have it. Democracy, data, and dirty tricks. The self-proclaimed digital masterminds who may have swayed an American election, offering to influence others by means covert and corrupt.
Mark, it's a great pleasure to meet you.
Great pleasure.
Yes.
Amidst the secrecy and stings, they spoke of offering to bribe foreign officials. That's against the law in Britain and the US. How much of this was hype? How much the truth? We may never know. In the dark arts of democracy, Cambridge Analytica are, after all, modern masters of disguise. From one election to another, ghosting in and ghosting out.
You're listening to Savino Veritas. This is a satirical show, but as I say, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding, because this is a very scary, frightening eve of destruction moment in the United States of America. We need to stand together and do something about it. I promise I'll be cheering you up momentarily, but before I do, I'm going to bring you down even more. Here's a tape I got, an audio I got very secretly from an entity called Anonymous. Listen very carefully.
We are Anonymous and we have been gathering breadcrumbs left by the Kremlin operatives who conducted the Cyber Pearl Harbor attack on America's electoral infrastructure. On June 6, 2015, Vladimir Putin signed the order directing Russian SVR to employ every means to manipulate the American election. 2 weeks later, Donald Trump announced his candidacy for U.S. president. Months earlier, Trump met with Russian intelligence officials to formulate a plan to take over the U.S. government with the help of Russia. We know this because we have a mole inside these operations. Alas, when children run operations, they spill milk along the way and forget to clean up. The Kremlin children sloppily left digital fingerprints, communications, and voice messages for Anonymous to find. Yes. We know how these amateurs stole the emails from the Democratic servers in Washington, D.C. That Russian team came in with all its little toys and vacuumed up the data, brazenly setting up shop near the Democratic National Headquarters until its deed was done. We know the Russians have operatives in two U.S. vote machine companies. We know they burrowed into the election systems of 29 states to cause mischief and remove voters. We know they have reverse engineered data cards used in two different vote machines. and we know they have perfected the skill set to wirelessly hack machines to change the votes. The SVR attack was an act of war against the United States to subvert its political system in order to destabilize and paralyze the US so that it could not effectively counter Russian aggression in Europe. It was meant as a warning that democracy itself is no longer safe. The SVR cyber war campaign was insidious and devastating. Stage 1 involved the stealing of sensitive information that could be used to discredit and compromise Hillary Clinton. This stolen data was doctored for maximum damage. It was then disseminated through the Russian propagandist WikiLeaks to make it appear to be from whistleblowers rather than hackers. Stage 2 involved having Russian agents based in pro-Russian countries set up fake news to spread lies about Hillary in order to irreparably damage her and suppress the vote. Thousands of such stories were leveraged into a massive disinformation campaign backed by a Russian troll and cyberbot army. This toxic flood of propaganda poisoned the well of democracy, and undermined the legitimacy and fairness of the election. Stage 3 involved the contacts with Donald Trump both directly and through surrogates such as his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Russian agent Paul Manafort. Trump has been compromised by the SVR personally and professionally, and Trump knows that he must play their game or be destroyed. For Russia, this is a win-win because either it has Trump as a puppet or it further undermines American democracy by bringing down another president. Stage 4 involved the placement of Russian agents and advocates into the Trump administration and executive agencies in order to ensure that its geopolitical agenda is realized. This is being done right now. Donald Trump has mocked the overwhelming evidence that Russia got him elected through cyber warfare. But now we have shown that the SVR plans and his communications with the Kremlin's goblins are not going to stay hidden. Vladimir Putin's D-Day declaration of war against America has now been exposed. Anonymous asks all respectable intel sources and white hats to flood the world with every scrap of data showing that 75 years after Pearl Harbor, Russia committed another unprovoked act of war against the United States. Let the response be as robust as it was in 1941. We are anonymous, we are a legion, we are everywhere. We are nowhere, we do not forgive, we do not forget. Expect us, respect us.
Mysterious, curious to say the least.
everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth. Be with us again next Thursday and every Thursday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time at 148.ca/1 and 24/7 on a Too Cool for School website, juicetalk.com. Remember, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding. Peace.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.